This is the Missing People podcast. I'm Steve Branum. Welcome to the second part of Kelly's conversation with Sandy Hopkins and Mike Hogan Sr. Sandy's the mother of missing Mike Hogan, who was last seen in Cuttingsville, Vermont on May 16, 2005. Their conversation continues.
Welcome back to part two on the Missing People podcast. We're talking with Sandy Hopkins and Mike Hogan Sr. They are parents of missing Michael Hogan. He's been missing since May 16, 2005 from Rutland, Vermont. He is a missing adult male. And Sandy, you mentioned in part one that he's considered endangered missing, and I know that you also mentioned that he's on medication. What do we need to know about that?
Well, it does have a significant part to play, I believe, in his being missing and our not being able to locate him or him to locate us. Michael has a severe obsessive compulsive disorder, and many people have this disorder, but there are degrees of it, and a lot of people are helped with medication significantly. Unfortunately, we never were able to find the correct mix of medication that would give Michael the relief that he needed. When Michael's illness kicked in his early 20s, you know, one day he was in college reading Aristotle and Plato, and the next day he couldn't even read one line. He just kept going back and reading it over and over. And that was because he was checking everything, and that's the type of OCD symptom that was most prominent in the beginning. It was very debilitating for Michael. I mean, he had to drop out of school. It affected his ability to have employment, and he himself made the decision. We looked for anything that would be helpful, and the first thing we tried was some surgery in Providence, Rhode Island that was experimental, had gotten great results, but Michael, unfortunately, did not get those results. I mention this because he was due back at the hospital to have some follow-up MRIs done and was having some different kind of symptoms right before he disappeared. And so that, you know, put him in a, you know, we don't really know what was going on with him then. He had also transitioned from living as a resident on the ranch to being in a group home in the town. And that's a very, you know, a change is hard. And for someone with a mental illness, it's really difficult. He was on, you know, he made the decision himself to go to Spring Lake Ranch to, main thing is to try to live as full of life as he could, as full of a life as he could, and to get as independent. But that was very important to him, to be independent. And he did well there until this change into town. He was on 8 different types of medications, and with mental illness, you know, they give you some medications and then they need to give you other medications to take care of the symptoms of the other ones. And he went off of those medications instantly because he did not have them on him when he left the ranch. So all of that medicine went out of his system rapidly and is very alarming, the impact that that can have. It can cause amnesia, confusion, lots of things. So those first weeks for him, I can't even imagine, you know, what they were like. The other symptom was this mild paranoia that Michael had, and our concern is that because of that, he perhaps is worried. And when all the publicity hits, you know, that he gets scared or paranoid that something bad will happen to him. So we think that that also has an effect on the situation. He's a very mild-mannered, very congenial person. People, you know, when I went back to the ranch after he disappeared, and they said, you know, the way they described him was, well, he was really a leader here. Everyone looked up to him. He always had a good word to say, come in and have a high five and really get people when he was, you know, sort of trying to pick people up. So, and very generous in terms of anything that he had, you know, he would share. And so he's likable and affable and very polite, you know, very well-mannered. I mean, these things just stand out about him. He's not dangerous in any way to anyone. You know, if anything, he would seem a little shy and maybe somewhat confused. But I think it's important for people to realize that, you know, there's nothing, you know, there have never been anything related to any kind of violence or anything like that. His illness is benign in terms of that type of thing, but certainly very significant in terms of the impact on this whole situation. You know, we feel that it's dramatic, that it really is at the heart of why he left and disappeared. We haven't been able to find him.
And I would certainly agree with that. If someone thought that they saw him or that he actually was wherever they are, what kind of advice would you have for that person should they approach him? Should they just keep an eye on him and call the police? What should they do?
Well, and Mike referred to this earlier, one of the things that's so difficult is that people think they may have seen him, and then they wait, and hours later they'll call law enforcement. And then, of course, this person's not in that area. So I think it's very important that they keep him in their sight when they contact law enforcement. And also, depending, you know, because he could be anywhere, to just let law enforcement know that he isn't dangerous and that he has this mental illness. And so that I wouldn't want people to approach him in a really aggressive way, because it would frighten him. That, to me, would be the best thing to do. I don't know, Mike, what do you think?
Well, you can't wait. Time is so important. You have to get in touch with whatever local law enforcement there is that, you know, this person is a missing person. You think you've seen him, and like you said, you have to keep him in your sights. You just can't say, oh, well, I saw him standing in that corner 2 hours ago, and, well, he's not there anymore. God knows where that person went. So time is critical, and keeping him close by. That's what I would suggest, is that, you know, you get in touch with law enforcement as soon as possible and keep an eye on him.
Have you received support from or maybe even met with other families who have a mentally ill missing loved one to maybe have a sort of a mini support group amongst yourself?
There have been different occasions where we have gone to different meetings, I guess is a way to describe it. There's an organization in New York State in Albany called Hope for the Missing. Every spring they have a like a seminar. It's an all-day thing, and they bring
New York State Missings Person Day, and that's our friends Doug and Mary Lyle from the Center for Hope, and I know exactly what you're talking about. They have it around the day of their daughter, Suzanne.
They're wonderful people. They're just the most loving people, and they have, through their organization, they have gotten the support of the governor and various politicians there. I went up last fall for the dedication of a memorial. It was wonderful. Sandy and I went to their seminar.
Remembrance service.
Right.
Yeah.
That all day.
Yeah.
Remembrance that they did in the spring of what was that, 2006, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then there was I don't remember the name of it, but it was in Annapolis.
That was the Maryland part of the Center for Missing Adults, the Maryland sort of chapter of that group. They did, you know, they had something here. And these things come up, you know, periodically. But as far as support for me, as far as, you know, the first thing I started looking for was a support group, just some other people that have gone through this that I could meet with, physically be with. And there wasn't anything. And I was told that, you know, in this area that I could easily get to. And I was told that it was, you know, it's hard to keep those groups going. And you know, it's, I guess it's not like AA where there are many, many, many more people to keep the support going. So, you know, I really relied on on the phone speaking to you, Kelly, and to Monica Kaysen at the Q Center and the DOE Network. I have a wonderful advocate there who's in Maine who's been very helpful, Chrissy. And so in the beginning, that was really what I relied on as far as support, and just kind of muddled through, the best that I could. I was grateful for what was available, for the time that people gave me and the encouragement. And when we were in California, all of these groups really, I was getting emails and everyone was trying to help in these different volunteer groups. And so in addition to the people in Ventura who were wonderful, we also, had this support. But I do feel sort of alone a lot in terms of, the whole situation. It's just not anything that I ever thought would ever happen to me and our family, because Michael was close to our family. His father's and mine, and he has, brother and sister. I have brother and sister with his dad, who's very close to. In fact, that weekend he was scheduled to come home for a visit, and it was his brother's high school graduation. So we kept thinking he would show up for that. I'd just find his way home some way. Mike went to the graduation, and I sat at Mike's house just in case he showed up, thinking that that would be a possibility. We didn't want him to show up and nobody be there. So, he has a lot of connections and people that care about him and that he cares about, and it makes this all, very, very mysterious.
How has your life's changed since then?
Well, there's an emptiness. There's always this person who was so important and so much a part of our lives is, there's a hole that hasn't been filled and never going to be filled until he fills it.
My husband says exactly the same thing about the hole that can't be filled. Onward. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Well, it's really bad on his birthday and on holidays. Holidays are really difficult to get through for me. I still have my son and my other son and my daughter and my wife and the rest of the family. So I try to keep positive and not to show how I'm really feeling, but there is someone who is very much a part of my life, and he's not around, and I don't know. I just don't have the answer.
And,
just like you said, there's a hole that needs
yeah.
to be filled, and he's the only person who can fill it.
It just seems like for me that I'm in a dream or something. What's so strange to me is the first several months that Michael was missing, I would lay in bed at night, and I would hear all these noises in the house, and I would get up four or five times because I felt for sure he had walked in. And, I would look around the house and then go back to bed, and this went on night after night. I don't even hear the noise. There aren't any noises anymore. I don't know how to explain that. But, whether I'm just not hearing them or what happened, but that was, I just went through days like that. I was on the Internet. I would work. I did take several weeks off, and then I tried to get back to work, and I'd work during the day, and I'd be on the Internet, like till 2 or 3 in the morning, some of it productive, some of it not productive, just trying to do something that, that would keep things moving forward, that I felt like something was going on, and he wasn't, forgotten. Michael is my only child, and it's a very big loss, and I get through it with prayer. We had Mike's dad's in the choir, and on Michael's 30th birthday, we had a mass, and all of the choir came, and it was just really beautiful in this little chapel, and the support that we got spiritually from that was really important. And again, like Mike, I said to my nephew, who's very close friends with my son, in fact, I'm going out to see him this Friday. He's in San Francisco. And he talked about something, and he said, and I said, well, Jeff, you just have to put this thoughts out of your mind and replace them with positive thoughts. You have to control your mind. He said, well, how can you do that? And that was so significant for me because I realized that you do it with practice, and every time I have a sad thought about my goal, I replace it with a hopeful one, and it's become, you know, pretty much automatic. But like I said, this last anniversary of his being missing was, it was really difficult to do that, very difficult. And when I, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll just talk to Mike because, you know, or he'll stop over and we'll connect, you know, it's our son, and it, you know, just speaking with him can be a big help for me. Seems like I'm all, when I'm down, he's up, so far it's been kind of working okay. He's picked me up a few times.
We get a call every year, well, not like it's the first anniversary, the news reporter from the Rutland Herald called to see how things were going and how we were doing. And then this past year, the second anniversary, he called again. And that's what he asks is, how do you stay up? And there are times when I think too much. I have to just stop thinking. Not that I stop thinking about Michael, but it's like I think I can find him in my head. I can reason all this out, and I'm going to come up with a logical explanation. And it becomes too much. And the only thing I can do is just shut it off. But I, you know, this past year there was some very encouraging news about missing people. There's a program on television called Court TV, and I had heard that Michael was on it. They do a segment on missing people, and there was a story about a young lady. Now, I don't think she had any mental problems, but she just disappeared one day, and she was, I think, 18 or 19 years old. And it was 7 years later that, this was in Texas, that the Texas Rangers, this one particular Texas Ranger, had taken on this case, and it was a quest for him to find her. And he did. He found her, and she had just gone off. She had an argument with her mother, and she moved to another state and started another life. And her explanation was that the longer she was separated from her family, the more, the guiltier she felt, and that's why she never called home. I don't think that's Michael's case, but hearing things like that, when that 10 or 12 year old boy was abducted from his after he got off his school bus, I don't know how long it took. It didn't take very long for the police to find him living with this man, and there was another boy there who had been missing for several years. And so you know, this was a situation, and those stories just gave me hope. And I don't know how I found out about that they actually did a spot on Court TV about Michael. I was really amazed to hear about that, and I had sent them an email thanking them for picking up on Michael's story and doing a segment about him.
Well, and those stories, you know, you look for the stories that have some positive endings, like Mike just, you know, spoke about. It's hard to imagine that someone you love so much would just disappear and be out there and not try to connect. And I think with these stories, it paints a picture of, you know, things can happen. And, you know, in Michael's case, he may have forgotten. He could feel guilty because he always, you know, was, you know, so concerned about us and how we were, and may have felt, you know, in his mental illness state, you know, that we were angry with him or whatever. So as strange as all this seems, it happens, and people do get lost in a lot of different ways. And so, you know, you can't just say, well, they don't want to be found. I mean, they may very much want to be found. But, you know, there could be so many different things going on. I purchased a print last month from an artist in the West Coast, Brian Kreshnick, I believe is his name. And I purchased it because it reminded me of Michael. And it's a very hopeful print. I have a hard time looking at his photos. I feel like I should have them up, but then I get sad when I look at them. This print is a picture of a young man on a boat, and there's a flood, and everything is being flooded, the house behind him and everything. And the little rowboat is riding on the water, and the person in the boat is almost dancing, and the name of it is Dances Through Disaster. And the lines in the body of this young man in the boat remind me so much of Michael, and it's such a hopeful piece for me, and I, you know, that's something that I can look at with hope and just hope that that's what he's doing somewhere and getting through. And I try to think about all his good qualities that would help him when, you know, out there. I mean, he's, as I said earlier, he's affable. He has a wonderful sense of humor. He's a man, and he's strong. He's very strong, and he has a good education and a good way with people. And I, you know, sometimes the mental illness interferes with a lot of that. But I, you know, I try to think about all the things that he took with him when he disappeared, all of the good things, the things that might be sustaining him now. And
you both have a good, healthy attitude, and you both have found ways to keep the hope. That's so important. And I remember very well the story that you mentioned, Mike, about the young lady who had been missing seven. Her name was Brandy Starr.
Oh, you know that story. Okay.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I believe she was working in a Walmart in Tennessee, and somebody spotted her in there and realized that she was the missing girl from Texas. So that was definitely a big boost of hope for me that, you know, she'd been gone 7 years, and I don't know if her mother thought she was deceased or what she thought about it, but there she was, and she was okay. And the boy that you mentioned, the one that, you know, had been gone for several years and was found with the other boy, that was the Sean Hornbeck case from Missouri. And I did think that Sean was deceased because of the circumstances. So that was a shock to me, but it was, of course, a good shock that he was alive. And it gives us hope, and that's so important for us to have that gift of hope. Very, very important. Now, you've created a website to help in the awareness process, and that's at helpfindmikehogan.org. So folks can go to that on the internet. What are they going to find on that website? How can that help out in the search for Mike?
There's a poster there that they can download. There are a lot to help you get to know who he was. He loved to write, and some of his poetry is on there. There's information about who to contact if you believe that you've seen him or have any information. We have a guest book, which has helped us so much to hear from people, just to know that, you know, that they were on the site, and that sometimes they're people that are friends of Mike's or family, and other times they're perfect strangers that have just come to the site and leave their words of encouragement. They're the major points, and we do try to, you know, if there's anything new happening, you know, we would put it in there, and so geographically, people in that particular area may pay more attention to what's there, and our story is there.
I read on here some of Mike's words, and one that I like reads as follows: "What a gift to possess, what so many miss, the gift of love and the gift in it." Tell us about those words that Michael wrote. What does that mean to you?
Well, to me, it shows his depth. You know, he is anything but superficial. The gift of love and the gift in it. You know, we use the word love so often and lightly. And to me, those words from Michael really show that the depth of which he saw that. And he often said to me, as far as the gift in it, that if he hadn't gotten sick, he would never have met how many helping people there are in the world. And he was struck by that, by the people that reached out to people with mental illness and problems and devoted their life to helping either as a job or as a volunteer, and did it with the gift of love. And the gift in it was their service. And so, you know, that comes to mind when I read that.
It's absolutely beautiful, and he's a beautiful person, and I certainly hope to get to meet him someday.
And I hope that you do too. I'd love to introduce you to him. And
is there anything that you want to share with the listeners as far as how can we explain to them that don't really know from personal experience, don't really understand what we're going through? How can we prompt them to want to help, to understand enough to help?
I can't answer that. I really don't. I think that people want to help, and that I think that people feel very helpless. You know, what can they do? You know, what can somebody do who, you know, I get people coming up to me at various times here in the town where we live and say, you know, I haven't heard anything. You haven't talked about Mike. Is there anything new? And that's what people come up to me and say. You know, they're concerned. They want to know if there's anything new. And if there is anything that I've heard, you know, I'll share it with them. But I really don't know what, you know, what people can do that are here. You know, if you're going to take a trip to California and in the Ventura area, keep your eyes open. that you can see them.
Yeah, and I think the internet has been, I mean, it really had a lot to do with that aid we got in California.
Yeah.
The fact that the website was there. So, you know, sending that link to that website to as many people as on your email list. And because the more people that look at Michael's face, the more opportunity or possibility there is that someone will find him. And it feels like a needle in a haystack, but I still... That woman out in California, she went on the website, and if you put his name in there, it comes up. And it resulted in some activity, even though it didn't lead to the outcome. It's still, you know, really, I think the one thing that we held on to and hold on to today was that was a year after Michael disappeared. So it gives us hope that he can survive and that he, you know, he did still alive. That was really important. Prayer is very important, and just stopping to look at the face of that person and think that I was just everyone else before this happened. You know, I didn't really think that much about missing people, and so all I can say is I hope it never happens to anyone else, but you can wake up one day and, you know, this person that's very special and close to you, all of a sudden you lose them that day. And it just happens from nowhere. People say to me, well, you know, I didn't want to say anything to you, you know, and it's like, it's so hard because in a way I can go, people are afraid to mention anything, but it almost feels like he's forgotten. And then somebody will say something and they'll say, well, I didn't know. And I said, you know, just letting me know that you still think of him, you know, we don't have to have a long conversation, but. You know, just saying, you know, I still think about Mike and I'm still hoping for the best. That means a lot to me, just to know that he's alive in people's thoughts and minds and hearts.
Absolutely. And we certainly will keep him and your family in our prayers. And we thank you for sharing Michael with us tonight and his spirit, his love of life. even though we know that it's been painful for you, we appreciate you doing that, and thank you for being on the show with us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This concludes the second section of Kelly's interview with Sandy and Mike Sr. You're listening to the Missing People Podcast, copyright 2007, all rights reserved, and held jointly by Missing People Podcast and Project Jason. Original music created and performed by Ariana Kima. For more information on Project Jason, please go to projectjason.org. To learn more about Missing Mike Hogan, please go to helpfindmikehogan.org. For my co-host, Kelly Jokowski, I'm Steve Branham with the Missing People Podcast.